Hello and welcome to the Oldie Podcast with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. And this month we've got a fantastic piece in the magazine by John Lloyd, who 40 years ago produced the great series Not the 9 o'clock News. And John, in your piece, you describe it having these absolutely disastrous origins. Are you overdoing it?
No, it was singularly terrifying experience. And of course we were completely incompetent. We had no idea what we were doing. Nor did anyone, I'm the only person with any television experience to speak of was Rowan. I was a hard-working and, dare I say it, rather successful radio producer, and I thought, well, how hard can it be? It's just radio with pictures. But it isn't. It's a completely different... Everything about television comedy and radio comedy is different. It's a different way of looking at things, and different. You speak in a different way. And I remember that what became known as the pilot, but was supposed to be the first edition, we just literally sat the cast in a straight line, and they sort of read from an auto cue. It was because that's what we did on radio. You know, you turn the page and, you know.
Because you were saying your piece seems extraordinary. The only time you'd been in television studios in the audience of the two runs.
Yeah.
But you had been, as you say, a successful radio producer that you'd invented to the Manor Born, is that fair enough?
Yes, I'm with Peter Spence, the writer, yeah.
And then stolen from you.
Well, not stolen, actually, but what happened was that Pete very sweetly said, come with me. Come as my co-writer. So I wasn't fired from that in the way I was fired from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but with To the Man of Horn, he asked me to come with him, and I had a job, and I thought, well, I can't necessarily risk this. So we had a go. He used to live in Dorking, Pete, and I used to go down at the weekend and try and write with him. And that's another thing I learned about being in a producer-writer relationship is one thing. When you are a co-writer, there's a whole different way you speak to somebody. And I was used to saying, no, do this, Pete. And he said, you can't speak to me like that. I'm your co-writer now. And we couldn't make it work. We always stayed very good friends. But I felt it was a lost opportunity. And that was what drove me to resign from BBC Radio, that these three programmes I'd started helped start Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, To the Man of Born, and quote-unquote all went other places without me, and I was very cross.
And not surprisingly, but why does you describe Douglas Adams as your best friend and then promptly he went and fired you? Why was that?
Because I don't want to say... Mm. Well, look, I think he thought... What do you think? Look, I thought of this, you know, now that everybody wants me, because he was several years in the wilderness really struggling to make ends meet, and so he'd come up with this amazing thing, which was entirely his idea, and he didn't want to share it with anyone. And the way he put it was, I think what I did on my own is very hard work, but it's better, which I defy anyone to tell the difference between the first four and the last two of the original radio series. And it was very, very close indeed. You know, we'd shared flats and houses together, and he was very cross with me because I had made a fuss about it. And you know, it's one of those things, we were very young and nobody had any idea one would ever could be famous or could be successful. We were just kid radio producers, you know. But we patched it up pretty quickly and went on to write The Meaning of Lift together, if you know that book.
I do, fantastic book.
I mean, it was
brilliant idea. Whose idea was that? Listeners who haven't heard of it, it's the brilliant idea that if you take the name of some very obscure villages, they could actually have a real life meaning. I think.
Yeah, it's a dictionary of things there should be words for but aren't. And all the words themselves are recycled place names.
Brilliant.
That's the tagline. So, for example, not necessarily obscure. So, Kettering is the marks left on your bottom and thighs after sitting sunbathing on a wickerwork chair.
Brilliant.
Or Epping, for example, is the fruitless movements of forefingers and eyebrows in failing to attract the attention of a waiter or barman. You know, I've been Epping here for...
Fantastic.
Great fun to do. It was the
idea?
The idea was Douglas's old English teacher at school, who used to play this game. You know, he was at... Brentwood School, so all boys in those days, and in a spare period or end of term, they'd play this game, and, you know, the teacher would say, so, boys, what's a keel, or what is a Walthamstow, and so on. And, and Douglas remembered this, and when he was trying very hard not to write the first Hitchhiker's novel, we were together in Corfu, he'd sacked me, but I hadn't money to go anywhere else, so he had a go trying to write this book, and by 11 o'clock in the morning, you know, he was... famously bad at deadlines, he'd come down to the taverna and we'd open a bottle and we'd play this game for hours and hours and hours. And when when I came to do Not the Nightclub News, obviously, that's why it's so germane. We did this thing called the Not 1982 calendar, which was a joke a day calendar borrowed from a Dutch format, which we paid for. And on front and back of the page, a big fat diary like this. And when we had published it, my publisher Matthew Evans of Faber, I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
Matthew said, "John, there's one idea in here which is absolutely standout. It's a very funny book, but this idea, it was then called the Eglish Oxnard Dictionary." I just found this in the bottom drawer, these things we played for, you know, several years ago. He said, "That's the one, we should do that as a separate book." And Douglas, so it's a connection with Not. And I said to Douglas, and of course, what we must call it is the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Glossary, or the Dictionary, or the, you know, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Dictionary. Perfect title. By Douglas Adams, I said, in enormous gold letters, and put me on the back in very small type, because nobody knows who I am. And Douglas insisted on calling this thing The Meaning of Lif, because Monty Python's, and he'd worked for Python, The Meaning of Life had just come out.
Right.
And he said, we should... We'll coattail it off that. People will mistake it for The Meaning of Life, and they'll buy the book because they'll think it's by Monty Python. I said, but you're much more famous than they are. Which he sort of was, actually. Before, no, that's not true, because the Python films made them famous, but Hitchhiker was a big brand.
A huge hit, wasn't it?
And, you know, he was, the first book sold, I don't know, a million copies in double quick time. And, you know, it's in the pantheon. And, you know, what I always say, Harry, is that at the time, you know, I was heartbroken and very cross, but since, I think, how lucky am I that he did that? Because otherwise I'd have always been known as the guy, who's that guy who writes with Douglas Adams? Because he was such a huge personality, I would have just been literally in his shadows, a huge personality, huge man.
It seems incredibly easy to get a programme commissioned by the BBC, so the initial commissioning is incredibly quick, if not that
Well, not now, it isn't.
No, I know it isn't now, but then...
No. The way the system works... forever, really, was that it was a very... the architectural construction of the BBC was very simple, and a simple pyramid, the baseline being producers. So we often say there's only two jobs worth having in the BBC. One is the director general, and the other is a producer. So the DJ was the apex, who set the sort of moral tone and the sort of pioneering and the, you know, the attitude of the BBC, you know, slightly different, but brilliant ones like Hugh Carlton Green would, you know, infuse people with, you know, and Greg Dyke was very popular, for example, at the BBC. And the producers, this great big base of people, whence came all the creativity, all the work and all the ideas. There were no development departments. It happened in your office with your PA or your favourite production manager or whatever. And it was a very strong system because all the responsibility was devolved downwards. If you were considered good enough to hire as a BBC producer, you were trusted to not break the law, to know where the line of taste came and so on. You took responsibility for everything, which is tremendous pressure if you're 22. But, my goodness, you learn quickly.
And tremendous freedom to be groundbreaking.
Yeah, because the thing is, the way it worked, the next level up, the heads of department, who were sort of like medieval barons. So the head of light entertainment was an immensely powerful figure. And they were all ex-producers, so they knew what it was like to sit on the ground floor, take responsibility, have the ideas, and so on. And they let you be. They hired you because they looked in your eyes and think, can you do this? Yes, you can. Okay, off you go. Make your mistakes. Come if you need encouragement. You know, if you get, please don't screw up, because we'll have to, you know, tell you off. And the controllers then, they were all ex-heads of department. And of course, they wouldn't, if you were head of current affairs and you got to be controller of BBC2, you wouldn't dream of telling the head of light entertainment what kind of jokes he should do, or the head of sport. You had a very, you know, strategic, you know, should we have a glass of wine about this? And but what about, have you ever considered putting snooker on? I don't want to, you know, push. And so, as I say, so basically, the higher up you went, the less responsibility in many ways you had. You relied on all the people below you. So it was an incredibly tough and resilient thing. And now that doesn't, everything is the other way up. So all the responsibility for everything is the person at the head of the channel or whatever.
Right.
That's true across all British television and most global television. So nobody gets any say at all. They have to refer everything upwards. So that's why you get all these scandals and legal problems and things, because nobody's really taking responsibility. They just say, well, let's refer it upwards.
You and one person has a huge amount on their...
Yeah, they can't do it. They've got the ridiculous workload because they're having an opinion on every program in every genre across their entire channel. It's a system that simply doesn't work.
But to go back to 1979, so you get the green light, and to begin with, the suggestion was that the show should be called Sacred Cows.
Yes.
And amazingly, its job should be to mock political correctness. And as you say, who knew political correctness even existed in 1979? But that was the words that were used, was it?
Yes, it was. Yeah. It was a very, very new thing. There was, in the 70s, you know, when all comedy was such an interesting pivot point, not that I think this, along with the comic strip, the comedy story, it sort of happened in the same couple of years. Because until the late 70s, the common wisdom in the comedy community was it was impossible to be funny and left-wing, that you had to be right-wing to be funny because, you know, otherwise how could you do mother-in-law jokes or, you know, fattest jokes or whatever? And that swung around. And today, you will really struggle to find a successful right-wing comedian under, say, 50.
And even beyond the fringe was... It was sort of satirical, wasn't it? But it would have satirized. It did satirize Macmillan, didn't it?
Yeah, I think so. But I mean, the generality of the kind of way you spoke and so on, we were unwitting. And then it sort of swung, really, in a very few years to a, you know, it's... Of course, neither is particularly healthy either way. You know, it should be... Comedy really should be able to talk about anything. And now we really do have a problem in comedy, where there's very few things you can talk about without upsetting somebody.
Yeah. And the title came from a newspaper parody called Not the New York Times.
Yes.
One can see the joke there. So, but Not the 9 o'clock News was not going to obviously be a parody of the 9 o'clock News, was it? But at this stage, no. What was your idea of what it would be like?
Well, it was an antidote, really. So it went out against the 9 o'clock News, 9 o'clock News on BBC One, and on BBC Two, not the 9 o'clock News. So it's an alternative. Yeah. You don't want to watch the mainstream news, you watch a sort of wacky circus mirror version of it. So it had enough bits of news, and Mel and Pam played newsreader couple on a regular basis. It was one of the funniest bits of the show very often. And yes, it was a Tony Hendra who was behind Not the New York Times, and was slightly griped about it, but yes, it's a fair enough nod in the general direction and respect for one, because it was a brilliant, I don't know if you saw the piece of work, unbelievably good. I mean,
Not the New York Times.
Just one edition. I think it was something to do with John Graham, who runs 5x15. I think he had something to do with it, but I can't remember.
But anyway, so to go back to it, and then you'd known Rowan Atkinson for a while, you'd seen him in 1976, and you say... You realise you were in the presence of genius when you saw him, which you wouldn't overuse the word. Why was he so extraordinary?
He just commanded the stage and the audience in a way which is quite breathtaking. I think only a year or so later, I saw him again in, I think it was called Pleasure at Her Majesty's, which was the Amnesty Theatre show, which had everybody on it. It had the Pythons, it had Peter Cook, it had, you know, the absolute stellar cast. Rowan came on, did a couple of spots and blew everyone out of the water. It was the best thing in it. It was just, because of this thing that I say in the piece, there was an edge of real cruelty to it, which is very unusual in comedy, actually, because you sort of normally need to like the person. Of course you do, you like him because he's very funny. But it was something that I had actually never seen before. Anyway, I went and knocked on his dressing room door after the first time I saw him in 76, and, you know, I felt I could have crawled out from under a stone, because he thought he'd done very badly. Rowan's very, very high. One of the nice things about working with Rowan is extremely high standards, and he's not at all egotistical about his work. He's very forensic, very, okay, I didn't do that right, let's do this again. Very exacting at his best. It's one of the things I really enjoy. I'm a perfectionist, so... You can really do things well if somebody is free of... Well, I thought I was really good, which a lot of people will do.
And already he became probably most famous Mr. Bean, didn't he? But already a brilliant physical comedian as well.
Yes, absolutely. And Mr. Bean, another show that I was fired from this time by Rowan Atkinson. So, you know, not a bit of a rubbish career I've had.
Your friends keep on saying...
not a very good friend, though. But I remember... That first time in 76 when I saw Rowan, my brilliant head of department, David Hatch, the man who recruited me to the BBC, came. He was a very sort of, you know, energetic guy, and he said, I'm coming to Edinburgh, I'm only could see two shows, I've only got 5 minutes to rush off somewhere else. Who shall I see? And I said, there's two things, David, that you must catch. One is this 16-year-old girl, black girl, who sings like Ella Fitzgerald and never heard anything like it, the most fantastic late-night cabaret thing. Go see that. And there's this extraordinary comedian from the Oxford Review. He's managed to sack everybody else in the... So I'm not the only person run sacked, by no means. Oh, and same with Douglas. He was a serial sacker, really? Too. It's not personal, and Rowan wouldn't consider it as a sacking anyway. It's just you become surplus to requirements.
Good euphemism, and brilliant verbally as well. That sketch, is that from the Secret Police's Ball when he does the school register?
Yes, that's famous.
Incredibly funny. Isn't
that was what I had in mind in terms of the cruelty. You know, it's like it's so one of the joys of working with Rowan on Blackadder and on the Barclay card ads. Have you ever seen those?
Yes, that's fantastic. That Shemley does that.
Yeah, you don't know. If you turn the sound down, they don't look funny. They look very stylish, you know, like black sort of thrillers or something like that. And then you turn the sound up and it all, I see. That's Rowan's got that really good thing. There's another thing Mel Smith had very good of deadpanning it. I dare you to laugh at me. I mean this.
Well, even in the picture, in the piece, you've given us some wonderful stills from those days. There's a picture I'm just showing to John of Mel Smith. Even when he's looking at you deadpan, it's very, very funny. He's got a very funny face.
It's a very interesting thing, this, how it is that, you know, people like Mel, Griff's also very good at it, people like Jim Broadbent, to be very funny while apparently doing it straight. You know, on the other hand, at one extreme, you've got sort of Norman Wisdom and so on, which is obviously knockabout, silly, or Mr. Bean or whatever. There's no attempt at realism. At the other end, there's people straight acting, the same people, but it's not funny. It's like, same line, but I don't know. Nobody knows what comedy is. It is one of the great mysteries. I've been doing it 45 years. I still have no idea how it works.
Well, Barry Cryer, who does a lot of work with the oldie, you know him, is very, very modest. He says he doesn't have funny bones. He thinks that Tommy Cooper had funny bones, Eric Morecambe had funny bones, and you've either got it or you haven't to a certain extent. You know, Rowan Atkinson has, hasn't he?
Yeah, that's something very special. And I think that, you know, I'm very fond of Barry and I've known him a very long time, and I love him to pieces. I think he's one of the great human beings. But I think that's right in the sense that he can tell a very good joke. He's a very good, you know, stand up as it were, but he's not of himself funny. The material's exactly funny, and he delivers it very well. But yes, Tommy Cooper, you know, you just come on, you just start, you couldn't help laughing. That's magic, I think.
But to go back to what you said, here it is, you recruited one of the funniest men in history, and yet you do this pilot, and at your own admission, it's a complete disaster. And why is it?
Well, I think when you start a new enterprise or you try to learn a new trade, you don't even know what questions to ask. You know, I looked at this, I thought, well, they're all saying their words in the right order. And, you know, it'd be like, let me think, supposing you're a very good carpenter and somebody puts you in charge of a porcelain factory. You know, you don't saw the porcelain and you don't, you know, stick it together with nails. You've got to learn a whole new set of vocabulary and I mean, quite literally, you know, you can't talk to your crew unless you know what the machinery is called. They literally don't understand what you're talking about. Not because they're not trying to, but it's just, you know, in any industry, you know, think of the jargon you use in a magazine office. There are all these shorthands and it's the same in
which seems second nature, don't they?
Yeah. You know, when I try and listen to my friends explain banking to me, I just have no idea what they're on about. But you must understand that.
And so in that pilot, it isn't the cast we're all familiar with. Who's actually in the pilot?
The pilot, let's think. There was a guy called Willoughby Goddard, who was enormous, you know, plump chap, who had played Gessler, the villain in William Tell, the television series, so quite from one's childhood, really. There was a guy, very talented actor called Jonathan Hyde, who now I think mainly does voiceovers, but he's very gifted. There was John Gorman from The Scaffold, Rowan. Chris Langham played a teeny part. I forget who. Did we have any women in it? I can't even remember whether we did or not. Now I know an interesting enough fun. This the other day when I was researching the article for you, Robert Llewellyn, the guy who plays the hologram in Red Dwarf, did a voiceover in there, and Chris Emmett did a voiceover, who was from the News Headlines, a show that I'd started on radio a few years before. So, and again, I didn't do very well. I don't think I even wrote to them. They just coughed and moved on.
But so, and you say you were saved from disaster by, of all people, Jim Callaghan. How did that happen?
Well, you know, the Labour government was in terrible trouble with all the winter of discontent and all that, and he just basically wasn't getting the support of the House, and there was a motion of no confidence, and a general election was called in between having recorded this mess and transmitting it. We'd recorded it, we'd edited it, and then it was revealed in all its glory that I'm not saying there was nothing in it, Harry. There were some very, very good jokes, but not enough to sustain half an hour. And, you know, because Sean Hardy's very, very bright co-producer, you can see many of the things immediately you've done wrong, which is it's too static. There's no interesting camera angles. We haven't rehearsed them and blocked them. We picked the wrong people because no fault of theirs. They're all great people. There's no chemistry. They're all different ages. They don't have the same sensibility. There's no attitude. And one of the great things about the four we ended up with, everyone's got a sort of, you know, they felt like a rock band. It was really exciting, especially as they got to know each other better.
And you start to do that, and so then you recruit Mel Smith, Griffiths Jones, and Pamela Stevenson. But again, at this stage, are you in a panic, or do you see immediately, this is going to work?
I think the first series in the autumn of 79, they're always thinking it was very, very rough and ready. And I think actually we got quite good ratings. We went at 5 million to start when it dropped off by about 2 in the second episode. And I think it was only in the third episode you start there's one idea. That was a sketch by Andy Hamilton, another many people who went on to be very successful after getting their break there. He wrote a sketch called The Stunt Pope, so that the Pope has a stunt pope to do his stunts for him, you know, which is a very, very funny idea. Chris Langham played the Pope. And then there started to be, you know, we were a bit, again, a lot of intellect in that room, a bit too clever for our own good. And we managed to, it's a bit like good writing, isn't it? Good writing is plain and simple and direct. Bad writing is over florid and show-offy. And we were showing off a bit. We're trying to be a bit too political. You know, we wouldn't have anything as boring as newsreaders. We thought the two Ronnies had done that. And when you think the reason they did it was because it's a very good format. We'll borrow that. But it was an uncomfortable thing because, you know, Chris particularly was, which we've, you know, long since had a conversation about it. You know, he was not going through a good patch and, you know, he could be tricky. And he went into AA and NA and, you know, sorted himself out a bit. But that was kind of difficult because he wasn't, although he's in many ways the person I knew best, he wasn't a joiner-upper in the way that Griff became the cement that meant that they all... And there were silly things, like one of the reasons the BBC didn't want him was that way ahead of his time, he refused to shave in front of the camera. He thought it was way ahead of his time. Everybody at the BBC shaved in front of the camera if they weren't wearing a dinner jacket. And they felt he wasn't right. And at the time, I didn't agree. I thought, but no, he's what makes it edgy and harsh, you know, and a little bit strange.
Well, you say you called him at that stage the best theatre actor, director, and designer of his generation, which has been.
No, that was Griff, not Chris.
Yeah, sorry, Griff. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Sorry. But, yeah. That's been eclipsed by his stardom as a performer. But that was.
Yeah, and I've often thought, you know, Harry, that I think Mel could have been also one of the great straight actors, one of the great potentially.
He did a bit, didn't he? He played.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, but. you know, God save us from fame and riches, you know, because I managed to, and Griff should have, I think, in another universe, he would have been, you know, Trevor Nunn or Richard Eyre or Sir Peter Hall. I mean, he definitely has that talent. But what if I somehow pushed him into a, you know, farcer and, you know, light documentaries?
Who's to say that isn't better? It's funny, isn't it? It's done. We had an article by Roger Lewis a few months ago saying it's funny how comedy is sort of semi-looked down upon, much, much harder
always
to be
has been.
Ronnie Barker than to be, I don't know, Proust. That's a silly comparison, but actually it's always considered lightweight because it's funny, but it's bloody difficult, isn't it?
It is. Well, I don't know another job, but so I find it being jolly difficult being Proust, I think.
Yeah, but, I'll give it a go.
So I was going to say about Griff.
About how brilliant he was, that he used to call him the extraordinary theatre actor and director and designer.
One of the things that's been great for me in my life is this serial being sacked by people, because it keeps you humble, you know, it keeps you modest, sometimes makes you very bitter and angry. But I have to start again all the time. So I've never got to the point where I've so much money I don't have to work, or so much acclaim that I start to believe my own myth.
Yes, it drives people mad, doesn't it?
Yeah. You don't want to... Because I don't think it's one of my theories. You actually can't do good work if you have an ego at work. You can't do it. You have to be ego free. You can be as much of a swine as you want in the evenings, but if you're doing real work, you're in the zone. It's not really you doing it. It's the sort of the numinous. It's the you're somehow a tool of something larger than yourself.
And the somebody once said this about editing magazines, actually, it doesn't matter if someone's annoying or terrible, all that matters is the magazine or the film, all that matters is making it better. So one rises above oneself.
You know? I didn't know that, I never heard that, but that was what I was like as a young producer, and I was implacable about keeping the standards high, and I probably hurt a lot of people's feelings by being very, you know, ruthless and tough, because the program was the thing. And I still do that. I often say to the staff at QI, especially new ones, you don't work for me. We all work for the project. I work for the project the same. It's just that I am, you know, the project's intercessor on Earth, as it were. So I'm more in touch because I've been doing it longer. But otherwise, you work for yourself. And I pay you to do that. And I want to know what you think. Don't guess what I think. So I've kept that original idea, but in a much more benevolent way, because now I like people to be happy at work. I like people to come to work. And the actors were very happy. They had a fantastic time.
Well, also the extraordinary thing is Mel Smith, who's the son of a bookie, was thinking of joining his father's company.
Yeah,
so he wasn't, his career can't have been going that well.
Well, he hated being an assistant director at the Royal Court, and just thought it was all Ponzi and, you know, pointless and pretentious and all that kind of thing. And he was within days of going back to work for his dad. And I didn't know that until after he died. That was only then did I find that out.
And then, as you say, quite straightforwardly, you needed a woman, and there you found this fantastic woman, Pamela Stevenson, and that her only notable part before then was as a tousled head in someone's bed in Minder. So she wasn't well known.
She'll probably correct me. There probably were things, and she may have well worked in Australia or New Zealand, where she originally came from, but she was very much below the radar. I had certainly never seen her before. And, you know, she was hanging out with, what was her boyfriend, Nick? What was this blooming name? Ashamed. God, I know him so well. Yeah, so, and actually, I did ask her first time round. She said, I can't. I've got a big part in a starring in an ITV straight drama. And I was so upset. And so I thought that was my sort of third or fourth big failure in terms of hooking somebody. And then as it got closer and closer to transmission, then there was the ITV strike. You were too young to remember. ITV went on strike, so all the programming was cancelled. And she became free. And I rang her up and said, can you do it now? She said yes.
And then in terms of the writing and the rehearsal, and as I say, you've got this fantastic picture of you in rehearsal, how did it work It was a shared thing, or you and Rowan dominating, or what was
no,
it?
Definitely not, no. Not at all. Rowan was not a dominant force, really. We used to have this thing called roughening and plumpening, and this is Mel was really, I would say, the tone of it was set more by Mel than anybody else because of that deadpanning thing. We obviously, Sean and I had, you know, too brainy for our own good, very brainy writers, and we would, you know, come up with all sorts of plans and ideas. But the sort of way, the acting style of Not the Nine is Mel's, because it's like, it's authentic. The dialogue in a sketch isn't, oh, hello, Mr. Yes, we used to call it Knock Knock, Come In, Perkins. It's, Knock Knock, yes, come in, Perkins. How long have you been at this zoo? Well, sir, I've been at the zoo a number of years. Yes, and have you ever seen a zebra before, Perkins? You know, that way, that's a very sort of, I'm sorry, I'll read that again.
Yeah.
Style. It's sort of formalistic.
Right.
But sort of, you know, it can be very funny, but it's, Mel's thing is like, you know, the way you and I are speaking now with ums and ers, and those would be deliberately, we'd take the line and muck about with it so that it sounded like it was a real person talking. If you think of the sketch Gerald the Griller, for
example.
The famous
one, yeah.
Which definitely came in, written by Colin Bostock Smith, I remember, but it came in as joke, and all those things like, just the way they speak to each other, because there's a subtext. It's clearly there's a slight, you know, thing going on between Gerald and the professor, you know, possibly something, so a little bit of sexual frisson there, maybe. And so the sketches have enormous emotional weight. They're not just a sort of, you know, a cartoon. They're about actually people and how they are. And Mel brought that to the table, really.
Which they then sort of continued, isn't it, in Alas, Smith and Jones, where they're having their head-to-heads. That's all about talking in an everyday way, isn't it?
So roughening would be taking the line and making it naturalistic, and plumpening was to add extra jokes in. So if you remember the sketch Constable Savage about the racist policeman who keeps arresting the same black man for ludicrous made-up offences. Wearing a loud shirt in a built-up area during the hours of darkness. Looking at me in a funny way. And those would be worked in workshop, as it were. People would, like a lot of the way Blackadder was put together, is people making suggestions and me choosing that one, we'll have that line.
Oh, yes.
And that was really good fun because you could see it develop out of nothing, really. Well, not nothing.
Or coming up with a good idea, so Gerald the Gorilla and Constable Savage, or all the sketches. There's, like all comedy, really, there's an idea. Or sketch shows, there's an idea behind each one, isn't it?
Yes.
And then you put brilliant lines on top.
But if you think of, in terms of respected antecedents like Gunnar Peyton Dodd, again, they were more, although obviously groundbreaking, and Peter Cook, particularly the one person we all acknowledge as a genius writer. But, you know, it's you've been teaching ravens to fly underwater. Yeah. It's still a slightly formalistic working out of an idea. Or the one-legged Tarzan, for example.
Yeah.
It's not about what Mel brought to it. And then Rowan had utmost respect for Mel. I often thought Atkinson and Smith, that would have been a heck of a show. They often did things together. They were very good in partnership. A lot of respect. And Mel pushed Rowan again to go with the sort of cruel side of himself, you know, to be authentic. So but everybody bore some responsibility, but on the whole, Rowan would generally sit back politely, because he's a very polite, well-mannered person, and wait until the arguments had been gone through, and there might be some writers in there, or me and Sean kicking stuff about, or... And sometimes agonizing, you know, take all morning to get one line right. But the results, at the end of the day, they were so good. And a lot of stuff would have just, it's a very good, very funny little quickie where is there lots of, set in a loo, a gents urinal, and Rowan as a punk comes in. He's got the spiky hair and the zips all over his jeans and jacket. And he unzips his fly and he can't find his willy. So he tries the zip on his knee and it's not in there. It's not on the other knee. It's not in his elbow.
That's brilliant physical comedy.
Yeah, it's very, very funny. And that's enough. That's how it came in. Punk goes to the loo and can't find work, Willie's in.
Which, acted by a not very good comic actor, wouldn't work.
Yeah, but then what the crowning glory is, into the loo walks Griff Rhys-Jones as a businessman wearing a zipper bag over his shoulder, and he laughs at this guy and then unzips the bag, and the bag pees into the urinal. And you go, that's so cool. It's so... And that's what I used to love about going to work is, you know, just from thin air, this extension of... And not that Anecdote News is very good at that. It was very good at going beyond the formalistic into an extension, which is suddenly it's somewhere up there, which is magic, actually.
And in terms of the writing, there were outside writers, but you also wrote bits of it in all the four...
I did write some. Well, I wrote a lot, but I considered as BBC producer, it was my job to edit. You know, rewriting is part of editing, and so I've never really earned anything from it. And making the sketches better was part of my job. Same with Blackadder, you know, put in lines and things, but that's part of the job. I was on a salary, that's fine. Richard Curtis probably wrote, probably half the series, because he was always the default position. He'd always be around, and he was Rowan's friend and became a very close friend of Mel's. And you could always rely on Richard to do something at short notice and so on. And then there'd be about another, you know, 10 or so people, many of whom have gone on to become very successful, like Andy Hamilton, Guy Jenkin, and Colin Bostock-Smith. I haven't heard of him for a while. And so they'd be what you'd call commissioned writers, who'd be guaranteed a certain income a week, whether their stuff was used or not. And then outside that, people I'd brought with me from radio, probably 200 people who would send in one-liners or quickies or whatever, who were everything from building society managers to plumbers and people I'd built up along, you know, collected along the way. And their deal was, we'll pay you if we use it. And you're all in, somebody will read everything you send in.
Amazing. And you might just find one gem from...
But Constable Savage, for example, came in from a disaffected policeman. There was a sketch, a parody of the Two Ronnies called The Two Ninnies, that was from a disaffected Two Ronnies writer.
Yeah, how funny.
So sometimes people could bring off something, but usually it would be the germ of an idea, and the body of the sketch would be sort of written in workshop, as it were.
And it obviously clicked, because you got 17.5 million viewers, and that was quite... quick, was it?
That was because they repeated it once on BBC One, because it won big prize at Montreux and an Emmy, I think, as well. And so they, as a treat, I don't know why they never repeated anything else, if not that I could.
Well, I was going to ask that. Why?
Well, the 40th anniversary came and went. I wrote to the controller of BBC Two, I don't know, 6 months ago, 8 months ago, say. It's quite a big thing of its time. You know, there are 27 programmes that have never been repeated originally. What about at least putting it on iPlayer? You know, for the geeks and the nerds who've never seen that sketch about the Nationwide parody. It won't mean much to anyone. And we made a documentary 10 years ago that's very entertaining and interesting. And you know, surely we can do something. This is an asset. You know, the BBC didn't have that many.
And not difficult, is it? Take the tin down from the shelf.
Yeah, it is, but you know, you don't hear, because I don't know. I have no idea, isn't it? I'll get back to you, sort of thing.
Yeah, and we'll finish on you've got a mantra in your work saying, "Beware auspicious beginnings. Great things often begin badly." And is that because you're, like you've said, you're trying to work it out? So I'm a huge Blackadder fan, but I didn't think the first series was as good as the later.
Yeah.
It's working out what really, really works, is it?
Well, in my experience, the process of... Somebody said, if you don't make mistakes, you won't make anything. I mean, creativity, almost by its nature, again, we don't really understand, like we don't understand what comedy is or music or art, what creativity is. But my practical experience of it is having an idea having a go and realizing which bits don't work and correcting them and changing it, and then you get better and so on. You learn by your mistakes. You don't learn anything by success. In fact, you go backwards. The more successful you are, the less you learn.
And you might just try to repeat it.
Yeah. So mistakes are at the core of, and we should teach people this at school. We should say it's okay to make mistakes because you're getting better that way, as long as you recognize it's a mistake. And I think it's one of the best arguments for the existence of God, ridiculously, because, you know, when people say, well, look, you know, if God's so great, why does he allow this to happen? You know, why is he... These ichneumon flies, they're always quoting that, aren't they, sort of militant atheists. Well, the answer is, let's just posit that God made this thing we live in. That's a very smart guy. And obviously, he's going to make mistakes because he's very smart and creative. And he's, okay, there's a few rough edges. I must get around to sorting out the ichneumon fly. That's not right. You know, and so I think, you know, being wrong is part of it. I wish I'd known that back in the day. You're just frightened and, you know, angry. And now I think, then I used to think it was important to be clever, and now I think it's important to be ignorant. You know, I'm the professor of ignorance at Southampton Southern University and very proud of that. It's not a joke. It's so lovely to know nothing, because then you're free. You don't have to prove anything to anyone. I don't have to win an argument or come first in a debate. You can just let things unfold.
Let the shouters shout. And so one last question, Barry Cryer again, who I've just been having lunch with, but he doesn't like the label alternative comedy, which he thinks is just invented by a journalist. And so in terms of Not Narcotic News, where do you put it in the sort of development of 20th century comedy? Do you see it as a seamless development from Beyond the Fringe, Monty Python, The Goodies, etc.? Or do you think some big revolution happened there?
No, I think there were revolutionary things within it, which is, I often quote the fact that Pamela Stevenson, really almost from the start, was not cast as the bimbo, the nurse, or the sex interest. She was cast as the barrister and the doctor and so on. I remember we thought of that. Why don't we cast Pamela as the doctor rather than Griff? And I remember thinking that's a revolutionary idea, to take the woman seriously as a... And I thought, this is ridiculous. My GP's a woman and always has been. Why did I even think that was original? But one of the things we tried to do or not was catch the culture up from where it got stuck in the Two Ronnies, which is Two Ronnies, a program I adulate, always have done. It's a brilliant piece of work. But it was sort of set in some magical Brexit 1940s, you know, where everybody went to cocktail parties and they wore blazers and cavalry twills. Yeah. And when people went to the pub, they played Shove Ha'penny, a game I had never seen. You know, we played Asteroids and Space Invaders when we went to the pub. And we tried to pull, that was definitely a thought-provoking idea. That it looked, Not the News looked what the life we live was like. Camden Lock, leather jackets, you know, people smoking too much, probably a lot of drinking. That's what BBC was like. So that was quite new. But the effect of it is actually... It's a very odd thing. The best of Not the 9 o'clock News still stands up, I think, in a way. Quite a lot of Monty Python doesn't.
No, often, I'm afraid, very, very unfunny. Perhaps because it was dated even then.
Well, they were obviously genuinely revolutionary, I think. And I don't think Not the 9 o'clock News, we weren't trying to be revolutionary, we were trying to be funny and truthful. And that idea, one of the things that somebody came up with right at the beginning, which is the one great sketch in the pilot, actually, of Rowan playing... a sort of a Tebbit-like Tory, a sort of, you know, because somebody made the point is that things had got reversed, you know, that the comedy wisdom was that, you know, Labour Party is, you know, flat hats and whippets and, you know, that's you, the unions, my unions will not, and the Tories all, you know, frightfully, they all got a grouse more and, yeah, you know, a bit like Prince Andrew on telly the other night. Just a simple shooting weekend. Not, but you sort of thought, we thought, well, this isn't true. So if we make jokes, that's just going through the motions. Cliche. What had happened was that, you know, Tebbit, you know, was right at the top of the Tory party and he was a trade unionist. He was the airline pilots union. Mrs. Thatcher, grocer's daughter. Yeah. You know, very, very, you know, lower middle class.
And it's also funnier if it's truer, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's an insight, and that's always great for comedy. Whereas on the whole, the Labour Party was Dennis Healy with his lovely photography collection and very love opera, you know, and you know, Roy Jenkins and people like that. And you think, well, that's why it's got, satire got lame, because it wasn't recognisable anymore. So lots of good little things like that, but definitely we just, and I think Barry's absolutely right about this, is it's only funny and not funny.
Yeah.
Some stuff passes for funny at the time but isn't, but it's in fashion, and some stuff is just funny. And that's what we tried to do. Our aim was to try, well, this is a revolution thing we did too in BBC comedy. Sean and I made it our, we couldn't always have enough material. We said we'll only do things that we personally find funny. That was a radical thing, because some of the older producers in the bar would say, well, I said, do you enjoy making this sitcom? And they go, well, no, not really, but the coach parties seem to like it.
Right.
And we didn't do that. We just thought, well, I don't care what anyone else thinks. This is hilarious. We should have a go at this. And so it's got heart to it, do you know what I mean? It's got commitment, and it's also, I think, a thing that, I don't know if I said in the article, but I think one of the things that's missing on telly now, and possibly in life, is larks. There's no joy. There's no fun. We had such fun. We would sometimes be absolutely helpless with laughter and somebody come up with a new idea.
Well, that's a very good sign. I think that's a good place to end a fantastic podcast by John Lloyd. And I'm very grateful for a wonderful article in the January issue of The Oldie. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you, Harry. It's a joy.